So let's just very quickly go through what we did yesterday, which is essentially to study the geometry associated to conformal transformations. What we derived is that conformal transformations, infinitesimal conformal transformations, are generated by this particular vector field that is quadratic in the coordinates. And we could associate a generator to each independent transformation, and we gave them names that you knew, like translations, Lorentz transformations, dilatations, and then a funny one, special conformal transformations. And then we discussed how to derive the algebra generated by these different transformations by looking at the commutators of the vector fields. And we saw that with some insight, the algebra generated by these generators written in this basis could be written in a different basis in a way that made manifest that the conformal algebra, which is the infinitesimal, that governs the infinitesimal conformal transformations, was the orthogonal Lie algebra SO2, D. Now, this is true if we are in Lorentzian signature. Oh, I guess I went minus one here. And if we were in Euclidean signature, you will have 1, D+1. So whenever you were conformal, one of the generators that you added with respect to Poincaré or Lorentz has a time-like direction. So when we went from Lorentzian, now we have two directions that are time-like. When we were in Euclidean, we increase one direction that's time-like. And that's essentially the statement that you have a non-compact generator in the Lie algebra, just like the reason you have a minus sign in the Lorentz algebra is that boosts are non-compact. You know, the magnitude of a boost can be arbitrarily large. Okay, I cannot resist myself from just making a comment that this very simple observation, of course, the subject is much, much deeper than this, but a zeroth order intuition of why CFTs may have something to do with anti de Sitter space. Which is anti de Sitter space is the maximally symmetric space with negative cosmological constant. So with zero cosmological constant, the maximally symmetric space is just Minkowski space. For positive curvature is the sphere, which you have an intuition for. For negative curvature is anti de Sitter space. And the point is that the isometries of an anti de Sitter space in D+1 dimensions is precisely SO2, D. Okay? So you see at the level of kinematics only that, so the Hilbert space of quantum gravity and anti de Sitter D+1 dimensions will have to furnish representations of SO2, D. Which is precisely the same symmetry of a conformal field theory in one dimension less. So that's kind of a kinematical hint that there might be a connection between ADS D+1 and CFTD. Okay, so let's move on. Now, the other thing that we noticed at the end of the lecture is to note that there is an insightful way of generating the conformal transformations just by combining the Poincaré transformations that we know extremely well and adding to it a particular discrete transformation of space-time. It's called inversion. For obvious reason, because it maps the inside of a unit sphere to the outside of the unit sphere. So just following your nose, if you act with Poincaré and with I, you'll generate everything else. So as an example that I just want to mention is that if you do an inversion, a translation, and then you invert again, so since you're doing an inversion twice in this combined transformation, this transformation has to be connected to the identity because you went back, you went far, but then you came back again. And the reason this is very useful is that now let's say that this is indeed true. I'm just telling you this is true. Let's see how would you see that this is true. So let's act here on some space-time coordinate, first with I. So we, if we react with I, I just get this. So I act here with I. Now I compose with P mu. So what I'm going to do is just shift this vector by a translation, which just shifts this, right? So it's just x squared plus B mu. I just translated, I acted with P mu. And now I invert again. So now what I have to do is invert this vector. What is this? So this is x mu plus b mu, sorry, divided by x squared, divided by x mu, divided by x squared plus b mu squared, right? And now, by canceling some trivial things in numerators and denominator, this is the same as x mu plus b mu x squared divided by what? I think it's one. X squared. Oh, I think it's one. Okay, and now what does this have to do with what I wrote here? Well, this is a finite transformation, right? I took a finite translation, I did an inversion, so this would be the form of a, well, this is a finite transformation, and now I want to see what happens when the transformation that I get here is small. So when BBU is, well, I don't think I have to write it. If BBU is small, I just expand the denominator here, right? And then you get precisely this gadget. You see? So that's, in fact, the best way to think about a special conformal transformation, which is a slightly kooky thing. Like, look at this, looks a bit horrible. But it's just a composition of very simple things. It's a composition of inversions that you have an intuition about and translations. Okay? And you can do the exercise of seeing what happens if you conjugate. By conjugate, I mean making a sandwich with I's on any of the other generators. And the reason I'm mentioning this is that when we talk about constraints that conformal invariance inputs on the correlation functions of the theory, it will be technically very convenient to check the inversion properties of correlators rather than checking the inversion properties, rather than checking the behavior of correlators under KMU, because inversion is very simple. Even though there is a slight cheat there, but this cheat will not be very relevant for this course. Let me just make the comment that the slight cheat is that while KMU is by definition a symmetry of any conformal field theory, there are conformal field theories that are not invariant under inversion. This is in analogy with parity in quantum field theory. There are theories that are, all theories are invariant under the connected part of Lorentz, but not necessarily under parity. So it is like, it's exactly the same. But for the kind of correlation function we will study in this paper, the acting with the IMU will already constrain the correlator in the strongest form. Okay, so now we're done with the geometry of conformal transformations. Now we want to start understanding what are the consequences of conformal transformations for quantum field theory. So let's start discussing quantum field theory. And now what we want to study is how to label operators in conformal field theories. How are they characterized? What are their quantum numbers? And how do they transform? So these questions you know very well for Lorentz transformations. You know that in Lorentz, under Lorentz transformation, fields and operators transform in a way that's dictated by Lorentz covariance. And the operators are labeled by the spin of the operator. So now we have to understand what is the generalization of that when you have extra symmetries. So obviously, we will still label things under spin because the Lorentz group is still a symmetry. But we will see that we have to add an extra label that will have to do with the eigenvalue or the transformation properties of the operator under D, the dilatation operator. Now let's start first with, I always try to start always with the simplest thing. So let's start with what is the simplest, not simplest, is what is the ubiquitous operator that appears in any quantum field theory? And see already, let's investigate whether conformal invariance says tells us something beyond what we already know about this operator. So in any Lorentz, in any Poincaré invariant quantum field theory, there exists a local operator that implements Poincaré transformations. So this operator, and you had exercises yesterday about it, is the energy momentum tensor. So the general property of an energy momentum tensor, well, first of all, any local quantum field theory has an energy momentum tensor, and any Poincaré invariant quantum field theory has a symmetric energy momentum tensor. Okay? So that's property number one, it's symmetric, and property number two, it's conserved. Its divergence is zero. Okay? This is a consequence of Noether's theorem. Which tells us that for any continuous symmetry in quantum mechanics, it doesn't have to be even field theory, there is associated to it a conserved current. And T mu nu is precisely the conserved current associated to translations. So T mu nu is the Noether current associated to translations. Presumably, everything I'm telling you here, you already know. If not, you have to stop me. Otherwise, it's kind of pointless. Okay.
We had a tutorial yesterday about it.
Yes. Okay. Good. So now, what do we want to know? So now we want to know whether, so now these two properties were a consequence of Lorentz invariance, Poincaré invariance, sorry. Now we want to know what constraints can we put on the energy momentum tensor given that we have new spacetime transformations, okay? Now, one thing that it's clear is that from the knowledge that you have of the energy momentum tensor from general relativity is that spacetime transformations are always, in a sense, generated by the energy momentum tensor, because the energy momentum tensor is the operator that measures deviations of space-time. And OK, so yeah, that phase means that I should write an equation. So if I make an infinitesimal transformation in general relativity, like a metric transformation, this essentially is the definition of the energy momentum tensor. So you get 1/2 T mu nu. You've seen this equation before? Okay. So it means that an arbitrary metric variation, irrespectively what its origin is, the linearized variation couples to the energy momentum tensor. Now, a conformal transformation, a conformal transformation in particular induces a variation, an infinitesimal variation of the metric, right? Because essentially what we're doing is a diffeomorphism. Okay, so what I can write this is that So, okay, so just at the level of intuition, that means that any transformation that's a space-time transformation will have to be generated by some, essentially by the energy momentum tensor, and which transformation it's going to be will depend on how we dress up the energy momentum tensor in a way that I will write soon. So if I do an infinitesimal coordinate transformation, well, we know what this thing is. It's d mu zeta nu plus d nu zeta mu, right? That's how the metric transforms under an infinitesimal diffeomorphism. Okay, so now, okay, so if this were, no, so let me skip the step of Lorentz of Poincaré because I think you know very well, so I don't think we have to worry about it. Now let's focus. So now imagine the transformation that we did was a conformal transformation. So we know what the right-hand side of this guy is, right? That was the right-hand side of the conformal tensor or whatever equation, conformal vector equation. So this is going to be, I may not be terribly careful with factors of two, but I can try. Essentially, what you're going to get is t mu nu, eta mu nu. Let me not worry about factors of two. This is not going to be important from what I have to say. Remember that the right-hand side of heat had the metric times the divergence of the conformal Killing vector. Now, all of a sudden, I get here an interesting gadget. I mean, this is the trace. We call it the trace, right? Because I'm taking the energy momentum tensor, I'm contracting with the metric. We call it the trace of the energy momentum tensor.
How do you get the divergence of psi?
Yeah, so remember that yesterday, the conformal Killing vector equation was precisely this one, right? So, I'm just asking what happens under a conformal transformation. This is true for an arbitrary diffeomorphism, but now I'm asking, I don't care about an arbitrary diffeomorphism, I care about the diffeomorphisms that implement conformal transformations. So now all of a sudden we see that obviously the trace of the energy momentum tensor is going to be a star in the story of conformal field theories because that's the property that is selected that distinguishes conformal field theories from generic theories because a conformal transformation couples to the energy momentum tensor. So I will write, instead of this horrible thing, people usually write t mu mu. Hopefully that notation is clear. Just means exactly that, just t mu nu contracted with eta mu nu. So now let's ask, broadly speaking, so what should t mu mu obey? So let's start first for the case in which we do, the theory is dilatation invariant. You have dilatation symmetry. Well, if you have a dilatation symmetry, you know, the Killing vector is just this, right? So delta psi is just lambda, it was a constant, right? I haven't done anything very deep. But now let's ask that, indeed, this is a symmetry of the theory. If this is a symmetry of the theory, it means that the action, more precisely in the quantum theory, the partition function is invariant under conformal transformations. So that means that this guy, this integral, has to vanish. Now, how can we make that vanish? And now we just remember that for a dilatation, this is just a constant, right? So how can I make this zero?
3 0.
Sorry?
3 0.
That's one solution.
Oh.
What's the most general solution to this equation equals zero? Sorry?
Total derivative.
I heard total derivative from somewhere. You said total derivative? Yeah, that's exactly right. If I make t mu mu equals d mu times some arbitrary thing, this will be an operator L mu. The integral of a total derivative vanishes if things are reasonable far away. Okay. So the constraint that a theory that is scale invariant is that the trace of the energy momentum tensor is a total derivative. Now let's ask for the other guy. Now let's ask for conformal, special conformal. Why am I so slow? Okay, so I'm not gonna write the special, now I'm just gonna ask what happens under B mu, okay? Yeah. Now the only thing that changes is that now the derivative of the Killing vector is gonna be linear in X, right? So, because the special conformal transformation, the Killing vector, the vector field is quadratic in the axis. So if I take a derivative, it will be linear in X, okay? So now, how can I make that thing vanish? Well, that will be, I will have to do an integration by parts that will kill the derivative, right? So not, that will kill the term linear in X. So that means that T mu mu now has to be the second derivative of something. If it's the second derivative of something, and you plug it there, you can use one of the derivatives to kill the x's, and then you're back to the case before. So it's invariant. Oh, catastrophe. Okay, so this is the condition that an energy momentum tensor of a conformal field theory should obey. It should be the second derivative of an operator L mu nu. So this is already telling us something very powerful about the theory. Now, something, and this is related to the homework you did, or homework or whatever the technical term is. Now, the thing that essentially you proved in the exercise is that this condition is equivalent. It's equivalent to the condition that the energy momentum tensor is traceless, which is looks nicer, right? I mean, and so I don't know how much time I want. So since you did the exercise already yesterday, you may have an intuition. Now, of course, this energy momentum tensor is different than this one. Okay. The point is, so I'll say some words. Hopefully, they make sense. If not, you ask. What I want to say is that for any symmetry. For any symmetry, you have a conserved current. So Noether told us that for any continuous symmetry, we have a current. But there is no such thing as the current. You can always modify your current and define a new current that still will be conserved. Okay? So from J mu, you can construct another current that's also conserved. And that has all the same good physical properties in the sense that it's conserved. And the charge, you know that to a current, you associate a charge, right? I think you're familiar with that too. So in some non-covariant language, it would be written like this. So if you integrate the current over whole space, that generates the charge associated to the current. Now the point is that the charge q hat, which you define in the obvious way, is exactly the same as q, okay? Because essentially the shift, okay, so let me, at the risk of getting myself into a hole that will take 15 minutes, but you can, so let's be clever. So how can I write an equation in which the conservation of j mu hat will be manifest? Well, I can add j mu because j mu was conserved. But now, how can I make something that if I add with j mu here will be automatically zero? Well, let's see if I know. So what you can do is, shifted by some object, let's call it O, I need letters. Let's call it M. Mu nu. Now, what property should m mu nu have for this to be true? Namely, for a mu, for j mu hat to be automatically conserved.
Anti-symmetric.
Yeah. So if I write this by an anti-symmetric operator, then this will be automatically conserved. Now you can do exactly the same thing for any symmetry. in particular for space-time symmetries of the energy momentum tensor. And the point is, and this was the point of the exercise yesterday, I believe, right? So the exercise yesterday is that you were given something like that, and you saw that by essentially constructing an improvement, and these guys are called improvement transformations. And it's always good to improve oneself. The reason we call it improvement is that we go from this obnoxious looking characterization of conformal field theories to this beautifully looking one, okay? So essentially what you did is that there was a way of modifying the, given an energy momentum tensor with this property, there was a canonical way of modifying, of defining a new energy momentum tensor that instead obeyed this property. Okay. I could say more, but probably I won't unless there are questions. Okay, so that's all, yes.
Shouldn't we be like already expecting something like this because there is no scale in a conformal theory? So you get the trace of the energy momentum tensor, you kind of expect zero instead of an energy scale?
Yes, but you all expect that, but imagine you didn't know any better and you say, oh.
Of course.
No, but there is a point here. So imagine now you take lambda phi to the fourth theory. Of all the blah, blah, blah I've told you, so this is a conformal field theory, there is no scale, blah, blah, blah. But now you compute T mu and say, oh, it's not zero. It's screwed up.
You have a crappy T mu.
Sorry?
You have a crappy T mu.
I have a crappy T mu, and then you have to improve it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also, it gives you yet another intuition. It tells you, for example, that I don't know if you did that, is that you now imagine I take lambda phi to the 4 and I add the term lambda phi cubed. You know immediately, with doing any, well, you should do the calculation, but you know what you will have to get on the right hand side here. What will you get? Will it be zero or not if I add phi cubed in four dimensions? Someone has to answer this, please.
That's
not zero, and what will you get here? You will get precisely the operator that has broken the conformal symmetry. So I think yesterday you were asked to give a mass term. So here you hopefully got m squared phi squared. So if you now add a phi to the cube term, which is breaks conformal symmetry in four dimensions, you will get lambda phi cubed. So this guy is really measuring the violation to conformal symmetry. So if you add an operator in your theory that violates conformal symmetry, it will appear here. The reason I'm going through this is that if you compute the energy momentum tensor that you were taught in, I was going to say in high school, but in your case, it probably means like 3 weeks ago or something like that. You will find it's not zero, and you will say, well, this is crazy. They're lying to me. We're not lying. This is this point. And actually, the fact that you can do this improvement transformation is useful in many contexts, not only for space-time symmetries. You can also do it for any global symmetry. Okay. So we discussed the canonical operator that any field theory and conformal field theory will have. Now we have to discuss more but there are more operators in life than the energy momentum tensor. So let's discuss now operators in a conformal field theory. Yeah, let me try to use some consistent notations, otherwise it will be a spectacle. And this is supposed to be relatively simple, so don't be scared. So you're already familiar from, as I said, from field theory, standard field theory, that operators are labeled by their transformation properties under Lorentz transformations. We call this spin, right? So whether it's a spin zero field or spin one operator or whatever. But now we have an interesting operator in the game, which is the dilatation operator. Remember, the dilatation operator is the one that we've always been discussing. So now we're going to label operators not only by the Lorentz spin, but under the dilatation operator. That's going to tell us, and that guy is called the scaling dimension. The eigenvalue of the dilatation operator is the scaling dimension. We use this letter delta. Okay. Now, operators in conformal field theory, in a sense, are extremely simple. There can be they are organized themselves into families, into representation. I mean, more technically, into representations of the conformal algebra SO2, D. Okay. So, operators in a conformal field theory are either what are called primary, and the word primary means that they transform as tensors, homogeneous tensors under conformal transformations, just like the way tensors transform in general relativity, okay, like just linearly. And then there are things called the descendants. That do not necessarily transform homogeneously under conformal transformations, but that's one of the remarkable things about conformal field theory, that all properties of these operators are fixed by primaries. So the physics of the descendant operators is determined completely by symmetries in terms of the physics of the primary operators. So, of course, we care about first constraining the primary operators, and the descendants will enter when we try to put constraints on the data of the conformal field theory, which I will discuss at some point. Okay, so let me just give an intuition about what the primary and descendants is. I already kind of briefly touched upon when we were discussing the algebra. So I already discussed that the operator P mu. So now we're interested in the properties of an operator with respect to the dilatation operator. Okay. One thing I said is that P mu is a raising operator. For the dilatation operator. Remember that I said that D with P was P with one sign, and then K mu is a lowering operator. For delta for D. So one hat eigenvalue plus one, one hat eigenvalue minus one. Okay. So what does that mean? Just like in the harmonic oscillator, that means that if I have an operator, so when I'm usually going to label the operator O, or sometimes I will drop the delta because otherwise the notation becomes horrible. But when I want to make manifest that the operator O has a scaling dimension delta, I'll write O sub delta. I'm not going to write explicitly an index for the Lorentz quantum numbers. If you want, I'll write it, okay? A delta. So this would be a Lorentz index. This could be no index, otherwise known as a scalar. It could be a vector index with one Lorentz index. That would be a vector. It could be a symmetric tensor of the Lorentz group, blah, blah, blah. And this delta is just a real number. D is some generator, and the eigenvalues are real. It's a Hermitian generator. It has the eigenvalues are real, so it's some number. So now, what is this says more concretely about this is that if I compute the dimension of this operator, I act with P mu on O A delta, the dimension, the eigenvalue of this guy is going to be delta plus one, because it raised the energy by one. While if I measure the dimension of the other operator that I can construct with acting with the special conformal transformation, it's lowered by one. Oh, here I missed an important P mu, right? So this is still an eigenvector. This is still an eigenvector of the dilatation operator. So one raises the dimension, one lowers the dimension. The fact that d mu, sorry, that p mu raises the dimension is something that you have an intuition about. I mean, what is p mu? It's a derivative. And adding a derivative raises the dimension by one. So between friends, what is a primary? So a primary, this could be made much more mathematically sophisticated, but I think it's not really necessary. Primary operators are those that are annihilated by K mu. So they're kind of the ground. So you have an operator, you can construct a tower, then you go up and down the tower, acting with, you go up by acting with P mu, you go down by acting with K mu. The primary operators are the ones at the very bottom of the tower. I mean, if you're familiar with, which you are familiar, with SU2 spin, you know, you have a spin J representation, and the, I think it's called azimuthal, whatever, the J3 eigenvalue goes from plus J to minus J, right? So this is the analog of saying that J3 is minus J, or depends if you're up or down. So the top one is the highest weight vector. And then all the other ones are obtained by just, say, acting with J plus that will bring you down from the azimuthal component M equals J to all the way down to equals minus J. Now, of course, the more important difference is that in the case of SU2, the group is compact, so that the representations are finite dimensional. There are two J plus one states in the spin J representation. Since the conformal group is non-compact, these dimensions are infinite dimensional. Because essentially, if I have a primary operator, so how would you construct now a conformal family, a conformal representation? You will start with a primary, O, that's killed by this guy. And then you would, so this will be the primary. So you have O, the primary. And the descendants will be by acting an arbitrary number of times. All these guys will be descendants. And you can see that since we know the conformal algebra, okay, this guy should be mu1, mu2. Since we know how the conformal generators act on P mu, once we know the transformation properties of O, the transformation properties of these guys are completely fixed because I just have to commute whatever transformation I'm acting on with P mu, which we know, and then it's completely determined. And the thing that's nice about these guys is this, as I said already here, is that they transform very simply. They transform as tensors. So I'm going to write now down the transformation of a primary operators. And this is something that you've seen in general relativity, but here is specialized to the case when the transformation, the diffeomorphism that you're implemented is one of these ones that generates a conformal transformation. So is this discussion clear? I think it's supposed to be rather clear. If not, ask as usual. Okay, so. So we know how tensors transform, right? So the only thing that will be different from, and not, that's not different either, because in general relativity we also have densities. So now we have to assign a transformation property that will depend on two things. It will depend on the spin and on the scaling dimension. So let's start with this. So primary operators. So essentially now what we want to do is the same thing that you did for Lorentz, which is to come up with a transformation on the operators or on the fields that gives a representation of Poincaré or conformal on those fields. Okay, that's the name of the game. That's what it means to catalog operators with respect to conformal transformations. So what we're going to do is do a transformation X mu. So I'm going to use this notation. I don't know if this is useful or not, but it is what it is. So G times X. Okay. So that means that I act on a point X with some group element G, and G is a function of all those parameters, this D plus 2 plus D plus 1 over 2 parameters. Okay, so this will map, and this will be one of the conformal transformations that we wrote down yesterday. Now, what is a primary operator? So a primary operator will be, I'm not going to write explicitly delta because it was going to get out of hand. So now I want to know what happens to the operator under a conformal transformation. So this is, just to be very pedantic, this is a conformal transformation. Now, if this was a Lorentz transform, so maybe so that it's a bit more interactive. If this was a Lorentz transformation, what would you put here? And A was labeling the spin of your field. Yes, yes. Okay. So we would write a matrix L A B. Okay, and we'll put here times O B T inverse X. Okay? That's one thing. And now here we have to put, if this was a Lorentz transformation, we have to put a Lorentz element, right? Now, remember that yesterday we identified a particular matrix that was a local Lorentz transformation, right? So we talked about, if you remember, that matrix R. Remember that R mu nu. Okay, now, well, which convention I use, but let me write it again. So what did I use this? Yeah, so it must be this, I guess. And we said that this guy is a local Lorentz transformation, right? So under the Lorentz quantum numbers, I just do the same thing that you would do in relativistic quantum field theory, but I replace the Lorentz transformation that in Poincaré theory would be a constant, right? Just a rotation, with this x-dependent Lorentz transformation. And as usual, I don't know if you have kind of thought about this deeply or you have been told, so there are two transformations whenever you act on an operator. There is a part that acts on the internal quantum numbers. This AB is like internal quantum numbers, it's like the spin. So there is a spin, this in quote, spin part of the transformation that acts on the internal degrees of freedom. And then there is a part that acts on the space-time of the field. And we call this the orbital. You can think of that as the orbital part. And as usual, the transformation of the spin and orbital part are in opposite directions. So if this transformation is by G, this guy is by G inverse. And you should think about why that's the case. And if someone tells me, it's even better. OK. This is necessary for the operator O to really be acted properly by the Lorentz or the conformal group. Maybe I'll tell you what properties LAB should satisfy. Okay, so this has told us about the way things rescale with respect to spin, but now we have to understand how things transform with respect to dilatations. And now that's just what you know from general relativity, that you can have a density, like the square root of G transforms as a scalar, but it's a density. It has a non-trivial Jacobian with a weight that is precisely the dimension divided by the scaling dimension of the operator divided by the space-time dimension. So hopefully this formula doesn't sound crazy. This part you know. The only thing that's a bit different is that we have to put the right Lorentz transformation, which is x-dependent. And this part is just the fact that this operator has homogeneous scaling weight, delta. So it transforms as a density. And that's it. So it's extremely simple. The only real modification is that now you have this factor here. Now maybe a little bit, see, maybe since this, I saw a lot of blank faces, maybe I should say why. I'll give you a hint of why if this transforms, these two transforming, the orbital and the spin part transform in opposite directions. Now, what properties should the matrix L obey if I look, if I do two consecutive transformations? So if I look at a transformation G1 times G2, it shouldn't matter whether first I do G2 and then I do, it's the same as doing first G2 and then G1, right? So that means that L, I'm not gonna write all the indices, okay? So L is a matrix. So L of G1 times G2 should be the same as L of G1 times L of G2, okay? This is just the statement that L is a representation. Of the group, either Lorentz or conformal group. And now if you try to do this for two consecutive Lorentz or conformal transformations, you will see that you need this guy to be opposite to the order here in order for to have the right, for the operator O to furnish a representation of the group. Just play with it, it's not hard. Now let's look at a particular transformation that we mostly care about. So I'm not going to speak about Lorentz again because you know. Now let's see what happens under a scale transformation. And let's assume for simplicity that it's a scalar, so a scalar operator. So it has no spin. Then such an operator, O tilde x. So what is dx, dx tilde? Okay, so I guess it's just dx, dx tilde, just lambda inverse. I take the determinant, I get lambda to the minus delta. This is just one because I'm saying I'm doing a scalar, and this guy is just O of lambda inverse x. And from here we see the thing that we always had an intuition about is that these are the operators in the theory that transform homogeneously with some weight under a scale transformation. So if I do a scale transformation, the operator is scaled by some factor that depends on the dimension of the operator. Okay.
Should that delta be a D?
No, because I'm doing the determinant of a D by D matrix. So the D drops out, yeah. Now let me just write once. So this would be the formula for the finite, for a finite transformation. For an infinitesimal transformation, all that we have to do is expand this like we did before. Like just write x equals x plus zeta and compute delta OA, which is O at x, and what is this? There will be the, so now I'm doing under infinitesimal, right? So x mu tilde is x mu plus zeta mu, and now we just expand. So this will be again just the translation part. So this will be like the orbital part that shifts the operator. This will be the Lorentz spin. And this will be the dilatation. And now this omega mu, you can just compute from what we did yesterday. And it's a Lorentz transformation. But if you do a special conformal transformation, there's a correction to this. And then this sigma, sorry, this omega would be, if you just do a dilatation, it would be just lambda. But if you do a special conformal, it has an x-dependent part, okay? And now this m mu r is a representation of the Lorentz group in the representation R. R is the label of representation of Lorentz. And now notice again that even though conformal transformations look a bit crazy, at the end of the day, it can be thought of as just a local Lorentz and a scale transformation. For example, if I do a particular special conformal transformation so that B is non-zero and everyone else is zero, all that I've done is do a particular Lorentz rotation with this velocity and a particular dilatation with this strength. And now, one thing that you can check it already there by doing this exercise that I was hinting at, try to see the transformations composed properly. But one way that you can check that the infinitesimal transformations generate a conformal algebra is to remember that we already discussed that if you take two conformal killing vectors that generate two different conformal transformations, that they satisfy this relation, you get a conformal killing vector on the right-hand side. That's just a statement that you have a Lie algebra. And at the level of operators, now you can take the variation with respect to one, the commutator of two variations, one by a transformation parameterized by zeta one, and another one parameterized by a transformation zeta two, acting on an operator OA, you will see that this implies the variation with respect to the vector that's generated by the Lie bracket acting on OA. And that is just a statement that this infinitesimal transformation represents the infinitesimal Lorentz conformal algebra. Questions? So now what I want to do quickly, now we're equipped. Oh, by the way, okay, so another thing I want you to think about is the following. So notice that these OAs transform linearly. The primaries transform linearly. Namely, if I started with OA, the only operators I get here are OAs. I only get the guy like in the top component of the spin. But now imagine that you want to look at a descendant. So for example, the operator A mu OA, that's a descendant, right? I just acted with P mu on OA. What you will find is that if you look at the transformation law that I give you for AO and you compute the one for A mu AO, you will see that there is a part that, so we started with OA, then we generated this operator D mu OA. Now I look at the transformation property of this guy. And like the case of this guy in which the transformation property never shifted levels, the operator you got on the right-hand side was always this one. When you look at transformation properties of descendants, it can mix levels. So you can, in general, get mixing between different levels, okay? So in particular, if you do the transformation of this guy, you will see that you're gonna get a term that's gonna be proportional to B mu OA. So the conformal transformation of this guy will be proportional not only to A mu OA, but to the guy at the top. So they don't transform as tensors, because a tensor would transform linearly. It mixes levels. But what matters for us is that that's nice, but that anyway, all properties under the conformal symmetry of the descendants is completely fixed given the knowledge of the primaries, because you just take derivatives, essentially. Okay, so now I want to, so I think this next part, I think it's explained in a lot of detail in the notes, and it's mostly arithmetic, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. We're just building up our story here. So now that we know how operators transform, now we can ask about what are the constraints of conformal invariants on the correlation functions of primaries, on correlators of primaries. Okay, so what does this mean? So now we want to essentially, there's something that in maybe in a more informal sense you've always done in your life. You have a system with a symmetry. That symmetry constrains the form of the answer. So, for example, if you have, you know, two particles that interact with each other, and the system is translationally invariant, you know that whatever you compute will only depend on the on the separation of the particles, right? So, this is what we're going to do here, except that instead of only translations, we're going to use all these other things like dilatation, the special conformal, and so on. So, essentially, what we want to do is the following. So, let's start for something simple. Let's start, say, with a two-point function of an operator. After I'm done with this, if you're motivated, it should be a simple exercise to why didn't I start with a one-point function, you could ask. That's one comes before two. The thing that you will convince yourself of is that if I look at the one-point function in a conformal field theory, this is zero unless OA is the identity operator that always exists. Okay? So conformal invariance tells you that the one-point function of a primary operator vanishes. So, but this is, I will not prove now. It's a very simple exercise once we discuss the more interesting case of the two-point function. Now, so what do we know about this? Instead of making it, for this, we can use a lot just basic intuition. So what would constraints of would Poincaré invariance give us on this correlation function? So this will be some function that we have to determine. And this will be a function of what? Yeah, so x minus y. Because this is the gadget that is the Lorentz invariant, Poincaré invariant quantity that you can construct out of two space-time points. And now all that we have to do is ask what constraint D imposes on F, right? So we're just extending our space-time transformation. So we're going to now ask what further constraints does this give you. And with this, we already know a lot, because I already said, I don't know how many times, that in a conformal field theory, there is no length scale. So the only way that you can write things down is that things are polynomial in the coordinates. There is no way of constructing some dimensionless ratio with another length scale. So now that we know that under dilatations, things transform like a tensor, this immediately tells you that this function f of f has to be scaled homogeneously, has to be a homogeneous function of x minus y with a weight that's going to be the scaling dimension of OA and OV. Is that clear? Or, I mean, this can be spelled, one can write differential equations and go crazy, but I think it's better just to notice that when you write an equation like this, whatever you have on the right-hand side has to transform in the same way as the left-hand side. The left-hand side, we already seen that transforms homogeneously under the dilatation, so the right-hand side also has to transform homogeneously. So dilatation tells us that f of x of f, yes, that f has to be 1 over x minus y of delta A plus delta B. Is this a reasonable, are people reasonably happy with this? Because if I had made a scale transformation here, on the left-hand side, using this formula, I would have gotten something that goes like lambda to the delta A plus delta B. So it scales homogeneously, and this is exactly a homogeneous function with the same scaling weight. That's uniquely fixed. And now you can ask what a special conformal buys you, or inversion. And this I leave as an exercise, it explained in the notes, is that actually it constrains things quite a bit. it tells you that actually the answer will be zero unless delta A equals delta B. So you can only have operators mix, so they have a non-trivial two-point function, if the operators have the same dimension. Operators that have different dimension have a two-point function that vanishes. So conformal invariants will tell us that will be delta of delta A, delta B, x minus, oh sorry, x minus y to delta A. Okay?
How do you get the f is equal to 1 or blah, blah, blah?
By demanding that this side and this side is scaled the same way under a scale transformation, which is, has this thing. So if I do a scale transformation, I pick up a factor of, on the left, of lambda to the minus delta A plus delta B, and that fixes completely the function. Mm-hmm. Because there is no other object I can construct out of the Poincaré invariant coordinate x minus y that would not transform.
Yeah, but I'm a bit confused about the sign, because if then on the, you got s is equal to lambda minus 1x, then you get lambda to the minus delta A delta B on the bottom, which is the plus on the top. So I don't know how to change the sign. See what I mean?
You're worried that this should be upstairs?
Yeah, basically I don't know how to understand this.
If you sit like, try it by yourself and you will see it's the right sign.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there is no hidden, I mean, no sleeves, literally. And another very much brute force way of doing it is to demand that this. So what is the statement that a correlation function is invariant under a symmetry? Is that the variation under that symmetry of the correlation function vanishes, right? That's what it means that it's an invariant. Now I use the Leibniz rule. Right? And now I just plug in delta OA that I derived there and delta OB that I derived there. And this derives a differential equation for F, which has a unique solution, essentially.
Because this delta OA?
Yeah. Okay. Because that's how O transforms under a conformal transformation.
Yes.
So, perhaps one thing that you can check to make sure that all the signs are right, take this for a dilatation. And you will see that the solution, the differential equation, the solution will be this one. So what we learn is that the two-point function has one of the very important data of the conformal field theory, which is the collection of all delta A's. There's a list, which actually is an infinite list because the number of primaries above two dimensions is necessarily bigger than, is infinite dimensional, is the scaling dimensions of operators in the conformal field theory. Oh, by the way, I lied a bit. I mean, now we're talking about scalar operators. The thing will have to be modified a little bit once we talk operators with spin, because obviously, if there's a spin quantum numbers here, you need something here that has spin quantum numbers. But there are tensors that do that. And we will discuss them probably in the last lecture when I try to talk about conformal anomalies. So maybe I should make it clear. So this is for scalars, Lorentz scalars, for simplicity. And notice that this delta A's, so that the summary of this part is that delta A's are captured, are measured by the two-point function. And remember that the delta A's are the quantities that control the critical exponents if you were in a second order phase transition. So now let's do the three-point function and then I'll stop very quickly. Now the thing that's, so notice that the function is completely fixed. There is no freedom, okay? It's completely fixed. That's very different than in a Poincaré invariant theory where you could have a more general function that is only determined by dynamics. Now let's look at the three-point function. Now, oh, sorry. Now, what I want to tell you is that this is also completely, the one point that I want to show is that, argue at least, and there is no time for really proving it, it's in the notes, is that this is also completely fixed. So let me write the answer. So there is a tensor that is not fixed and it will be very important, some structure constants, C, A, B, C, that tells you how you glue operators A, B, and C. And now there is a space-time part that's completely fixed. Sorry? Oh. Delta 3 minus delta 1 minus delta 2, x 1, 3 square 1 half delta 2 minus delta 1 minus delta 3, x 2, 3 square 1 half delta 1 minus delta 2 minus delta 3. So the space-time dependence is completely fixed. The powers depend on the dimensions. And there is a new data. So what we have now arrived at is the data of conformal field theory so far is the collection of dimensions and from the two-point function and the collection of three-point functions C, A, B, B, C. And one of the miracles of CFT that we will discuss tomorrow is that this data alone completely fixes all correlation functions. Now, I want to give you, and now you can convince yourself that this makes sense. For example, if I use the same logic, if I act with a dilatation, this guy transforms us with weight delta A plus delta B plus delta C. If I didn't screw things up and you add the powers of lambda, you will get is exactly that. Okay? Now, I can give you a very quick intuition of why this had to be fixed by conformal invariants. And this kind of logic is useful. So imagine you have three space-time points. You start with three arbitrary space-time points, okay? Now, by essentially doing a special conformal transformation, or first a translation and then a special, you can do first a translation and then an inversion to send this guy to infinity. Is that clear? So imagine I take these three points and I act with the symmetry. I can bring this guy to the origin, right? And then I do an inversion, it goes to infinity. Now, these guys are somewhere else, okay? Now, what can I do? Now I can do a translation to bring this guy to the origin, right? So now I do another translation. Now, a finite translation will not move infinity from infinity, right? So I'm going to get 0, x2 double prime, infinity, right? But now, so this guy is a d-dimensional vector, right? So it has d components. Now I can make, I want to make a transformation that brings this guy to a form, to a place I like. But I have to do it in a way that I don't touch zero and infinity, because those I want to keep fixed. Well, which, sorry?
You rotate.
You rotate. So if you do a rotation, for example, rotations M1J, where J equals 2 2D, I can bring the vector X2 prime into this canonical form, A, 0, 0, 0, 0, right? If I have a vector, I can rotate around that vector to bring the vector to whatever axis I like, okay? So now I've succeeded by a collection of transformations to bring three arbitrary points to the point of this type. But now there's one more thing I can do that will fix zero and infinity and will bring this guy to a place I like. I can do a dilatation. A scale transformation fixes zero and infinity and I can canonically bring to the point 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay? So essentially what this tells you is that conformal invariance completely fixes the form of the three-point function because there is a you can always bring any three points to a canonical form. So whatever you write here, it's completely fixed by symmetry, okay? This will stop being true at four points, but this we will discuss tomorrow. Okay, thanks.